They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back, fans and followers, to the Magellan's at the Movies podcast. I'm Nathan Moglieins, the co-host of the podcast. I'm joined, as always, by the other co-host, Elliot Moglieins. Elliot, it's been a huge week. I mean, we picked a bad week to take a couple of extra days off because I have a big list of movie trailers that came out in the last week. We're going to run through them really quick. If you have no comment, you can say no comment. Or if you haven't seen them, you can say no comment. But let's start with, maybe in my opinion, the biggest one, the one I'm most excited about. Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein got a trailer. Elliot, have you seen this? Are you excited for this movie?
Yes, I've seen it. Yes, I'm excited for it.
Nice.
I thought the trailer looked good, and I think that this is a perfect story for Del Toro's sensibilities.
Absolutely. There was one shot in the trailer of Frankenstein in Antarctica that I was like, when I read that part of the book, that's exactly how I like envisioned it would go down, like that shot would work. So, yeah, I think it looks sick. Very excited for that movie. Next one's a TV show. Noah Hawley's Alien TV series, Alien Earth, got a trailer. Elliot, did you see this?
Yes, I saw this trailer. Wow. No, I'm not excited for this show.
Aw, why not?
It just looked very generic. But then again, I said the exact same thing about Alien Romulus's trailer, and that movie ended up being all right. So I'll definitely watch the first episode.
Yeah, I think it looks neat. I feel like it kind of defeats the purpose of some of the Alien movies, because, like, in Alien Resurrection, they make a really big deal that, like, they absolutely cannot let the aliens get to Earth, because it would be such a, like, horrible tragedy. And then in this movie, it turns out they've gotten there anyway, so I just find that funny. Another Netflix movie, Knives Out 3, Knives Out Wake Up Dead Man, got a trailer. Elliot, are you excited for this one? Have you seen this one?
No, I haven't seen this one. No, I'm not excited for it.
Dang.
Glass Onion absolutely punctured my any enthusiasm I had for this franchise.
I don't think Glass Onion was, I guess for me, Glass Onion wasn't so bad that I'm not excited for the new one. I think it looks neat. I think Rian Johnson's strategy of adopting different sort of murder mystery staples for each movie, that this one is like a Deep South small town sort of murder mystery, as opposed to the mansion murder mystery or the island murder mystery that we've gotten in the previous two. I'm kind of excited for it. I think the trailer looked interesting, and yeah, Glass Onion wasn't great, but it wasn't like an affront to nature in my opinion. So we're gonna have another one that you haven't seen and don't care about, though. Wicked for Good got a trailer. This is really exciting for everyone who enjoyed the first Wicked. I am not in that camp. I get the sense from the trailer that this story is going to be twisting itself in knots to not just, like, end really quick. There doesn't seem to me to be any reason why the Wicked Witch shouldn't win this battle between her and the wizard handily and quickly. I understand the wizard has some people at his beck and call, but the witch is... she's got a lot of stuff up her sleeve. I don't understand how she doesn't just clean this up in 30 minutes. Did you see that trailer? Did you care?
No. And no.
Oh, what a shocker. The last one, this is kind of an interesting one, and I am interested to know if you saw this trailer, but Andy Serkis is directing an adaptation of Animal Farm, and it got, I don't know if it was a trailer, I didn't watch all of it, but it was like a little sneak peek sort of thing, and it's been getting very differing sort of reactions across the board. I know you mentioned, I think it was last year, that you had read Animal Farm, that you really liked the book. Have you seen anything about this? Are you excited at the prospect of this sort of thing?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the footage. I've seen screenshots, and I learned that Seth Rogen is voicing Napoleon, which, speaking of things that puncture my enthusiasm,
oh,
I think that is a bad choice.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Because I've also seen some people talking about the art style, that the animation for the film is very child-friendly. It looks like a honestly, it looks like an animated movie from, like, the 90s or early 2000s, because the animation doesn't look very particularly high quality. And some people are really into this, saying that that is going to help the nature of the story get across even more when it starts all rosy and kid friendly and then kind of devolves, to my understanding.
I don't really have any strong feelings either way. I'm glad for it to not look like your average Pixar movie. And I can absolutely see the potential in this kind of simplified bright colors, glossy animation being married with this kind of story, but we'll see.
Interesting. That's all the trailers and stuff that I've got. Did you see something that I've missed here before we jump into the subject of our episode?
Well, I have now seen the entirety of Andor Season 2.
Nice.
And it is Star Wars for adults. Holy it remains cow. Star Wars for adults. Regardless of what my favorite Star Wars thing is, I think that Andor is probably the highest quality Star Wars product that's ever been made.
Wow. Really big praise there. I don't know about that, but I haven't seen Season 2 yet.
Not when I don't actually think that the original trilogy is incredible.
Yeah. That's interesting. I gotta get around to watching that. I did watch in the theaters, I watched Wes Anderson's new movie, The Phoenician Scheme. It is not as good as The French Dispatch or Asteroid City, but I think those were like my favorite movie from the year they came out, so that was going to be a hard metric to pass. I think this movie is really good. If you're a Wes Anderson fan, you should go and see it for sure. If you're not a Wes Anderson fan, I still think you should go and see it. It's really funny. I found it really interesting, all of the different ways that Wes Anderson continues to evolve his style, maybe not in terms of the broad stroke style, which still has a lot of dollhouse sort of looking sets and symmetry and things like that, but the way he shoots some of these scenes, there's an extended fist fight kind of at the end of the movie that is shot unlike other Wes Anderson fights, and I thought there was multiple moments in this movie that had really interesting camera work. Also just a fantastic, Michael Cera is really amazing in it, and Richard Ayoade is in it as a really great supporting character, so I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it's not the best Wes Anderson movie I've ever seen. So anywho, saying all that, Elliot, we've been doing a little bit of a journey through the decades, doing our best of the decades list. We're still working on the best of the 70s. We are, you know, putting in the work to make sure it's the best, most comprehensive list we can possibly make. Possibly is doing a lot of work in that sentence. Let me be clear. we're not watching every movie from the 70s, but we're going to try and watch the majority of the movies that people say these are the best of the 70s. So we're working on that. In the interim, as you wait for that episode, this was suggested by a friend of the podcast, Anna Brooks, who thought we could go through the Mission Impossible series. If you're unaware, the Mission Impossible series is coming to an end, purportedly coming to an end, with Mission Impossible The Final Reckoning, the 8th film in this movie series. So we thought, what better time? Or we thought, because someone else had given us the idea, what better time to look back at all 8? So we're going to be going through each 8. We're going to be saying where we rank them overall. We're going to be giving our thoughts on each of these movies. Elliot, why don't you kick it off? Do a bit of an overview for the Mission Impossible franchise for the people who might not be so familiar with this series.
The Mission Impossible franchise is based on a television show. I don't even know when. I've never met a single person who's watched an episode of that show.
Facts.
But from that show arose the Mission Impossible film franchise, beginning in the 90s, and remaining with us until this, the year of our Lord, 2025. And it's, if you don't know anything about it, it's heavily James Bond-esque, except American and better.
Okay. All right.
Think Impractical Gadgets, insane villain plans, high melodrama, huge stakes, like world ending or fate of the world type stuff, super spies, suits, fighting, car chases. Just all of the super spy things. And it's kind of style, I guess, is, especially in the later films, is about huge blockbuster set pieces with these often highly elaborate, highly dangerous stunts that Tom Cruise is doing. Tom Cruise is the main character, by the way. That are often kind of the front piece of the movie. So these are the things that you'll see clips of in trailers. They will be featured, often will be featured heavily on the posters. People are, in much the way that John Wick, in each of the John Wick movies, there's like a standout action scene, or an action scene that's clearly different from the rest. There's the same is set, can be said of the Mission Impossible movies, especially under the stewardship of Christopher McQuarrie, who took over the franchise with Rogue Nation, which is the 5th movie, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, and has been its steward ever since. So yeah, that's Mission Impossible. And it's got a kicking soundtrack.
It does have a classic, like once again, cribbing from James Bond, it has an iconic riff based theme that it's always a treat when it shows up in the movies. The dun 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 dun.
Thanks for that rendition.
Yeah, I get a kick out of it. I don't know. I don't want us to get demonetized, so I can't hum any more of that super authentic iteration. Anyway, yeah, I think, you know, the best way to start is by starting. So let's kick it off. The first movie of the franchise, Mission Impossible 1, directed by Brian De Palma of 90s film fame. 80s film fame, I guess you could say. Written by, I found this fascinating when I watched it, Robert Towne, the screenwriter for Chinatown. Fun fact. I don't know how he ended up tied up in this franchise, but Mission Impossible 1 from 1996, I believe. Elliot, where does this rank for you?
Yeah, this is my number 7, so that's one above the bottom.
Interesting.
And honestly, I didn't hate this movie. I don't hate any of them except for the bottom one. I guess I just thought that this movie was a little bit generic and a little bit overambitious. And sometimes there were very silly things happening that kind of complicated my ability to invest in the stakes. And I'm not even 100% sure that the filmmakers realized that they were silly, but... and first of all, we should say that there's going to be possible spoilers for all of the movies in this franchise. So if we start talking about one that you haven't seen and want to see, right, maybe skip ahead. Because I'm about to say that the thing about this movie is it's about Ethan Hunt. He gets framed for doing something I can't really remember.
Murdering his entire team.
Yes, murdering his entire team, being an evil arms dealer guy. But it turns out that actually the evil guy is John Voight. And John Voight, who we thought was dead because they've got those glasses cameras. So from his point of view, we saw a gun pointing at his face. And we come to find out, I was so certain that he would have had someone on scene to do that for him, but then we find out at the end that he's just contorting his arm to point a gun at his own face head on, and that's very silly. But in general, I just wasn't really invested in Tom Cruise and this woman's will they won't they relationship. And I felt like they killed the team off far too early for me to feel the characters' thirst for vengeance, right? And also they recognize the fact that Ethan Hunt has parents who are alive and well, and they just kind of leave that alone for the rest of the franchise.
Well,
but that's my brief overview. Yeah, go ahead.
I believe they mention in... like the third or fourth movie that his parents have died recently. Like the villain or someone says to Ethan, like, yeah, it was a bummer when like your dad died or something like that.
Wow, that's so clunky.
I can't remember. I just remember someone.
It's a very poorly written line of dialogue.
All right. Well, I have this one pretty close to that. I have this as 6th. And I would agree with your assessment that there's only one of these movies that I think is an out-and-out, not a good movie, is a bad movie. I think all of these are very consistent films. I think my issues with them are fairly consistent, which made it really tough for me to rank them. Because I think across the series, I just have... issues with some of the things. I feel like Ethan Hunt is not a fantastic character. I think they really struggled to give him any sort of personality through the films, and like it's tough to compare it to James Bond because I watched all the James Bond movies a couple years ago and I just fell in love with how stupid all of them are except for like two that are really fantastic. And I think this first movie is definitely borrowing from the worst sort of Bond movie staples. Ethan Hunt doesn't really do much of anything. He's on a vengeance scheme. Like you mentioned, we don't really know his team super well. The villain is terrible and doesn't really ever fully articulate why he's evil, which is something that happens multiple times over the course of this series, that the villain is just bad because, like, they were raised poorly or something. Like, there's no monologue, and you know, that's not to say that it's an amazing thing when a villain monologues their reasons for being evil, but It's difficult for me to find a villain compelling if they're both not intimidating and not an interesting philosophical threat to the hero. But Mission Impossible also, I will say this, has something in common with all of the other movies, which is when it does do the big logline action set piece, the movie is fantastic. The CIA break-in in this movie, which undoubtedly, if you've seen any frame from the Mission Impossible franchise, it's likely you've seen the frame of Tom Cruise, limbs all spread out right over the floor of the CIA deep secret vault or whatever they called it. And it's a great sequence. It is very tense. It's really well done. There's a lot of moving pieces to it that are fun to watch them come together, like the rat that's coming to scare the guy, and then he kills the rat somehow. That's crazy. But that sequence is really fun. It's just, yeah, like you mentioned, a lot of the rest of the movie is silly. A lot of it doesn't even make any sense. I'm unsure why the movie is even putting any effort into making us think John Voight is not the villain when he reappears right before the climax, and why Ethan chooses to go about his plan in the way he does. I don't understand. But yeah, it's not a terrible movie, but it's the sixth best of these movies, in my opinion.
That's very interesting, because I actually, across this series rewatch, came to really like Ethan Hunt as a protagonist. I really liked his... I thought that he's not complex or deep in any sense, but I really liked his strongly principled outlook, right? Like, he never compromises on his ideals, which actually comes to be a bit of a thorn in the movie's side at the end, but we'll talk about that later, obviously. But yeah, I just liked how I maybe I'm just a sucker for a hero in the tradition of Superman, right? A bit of a Boy Scout, someone who's just nice, which is one of the reasons why James Bond is so grating constantly, because Bond is just a jerkwad always.
I was talking to someone about this comparison between Ethan Hunt and Bond, and I was like, I just feel like Ethan Hunt has no personality, because so many of the things that he values are such, like, nondescript, obvious things to value. He doesn't want to murder people. In my opinion, that's not much of a character trait. Like, I don't want to murder people either. I wouldn't say it's something that, like, defines me. My reasons for not wanting to murder people would maybe be more interesting. Bond, I would agree with you. He has quite a bit of a personality. He has lots of things that he's known for doing. Most of them are not great things, right? He likes women. He likes seducing women with varying degrees of consent from those women. He likes drinking. He's good at gambling. He does all these things outside of, or somewhat outside of, his work as a spy. And in fact, I'd say his reasons for being a spy are probably the murkiest part of Bond's character. Whereas Ethan, it feels like, exclusively has things related to his work as a spy, and then everything outside of it I find very unconvincing. But we can continue this conversation as we move to what I'm gonna assume is gonna be the bottom of both of our rankings, Mission Impossible 2, directed by Hong Kong action film director legend John Woo. Elliot, where does Mission Impossible 2 fall for you?
Yeah, this is at the bottom.
Oh, whoa.
And this would honestly be at the bottom of a lot of film lists, even it's from a completely different series. Like, what's my least favorite Marvel movie? Mission Impossible 2. Is my least favorite Star Wars movie, that'd be Attack of the Clones. But above that would be Mission Impossible 2.
Great.
I'm just saying I really don't like this movie. And I think that John Woo was... I can see how this legend of action movies would superficially appear to be a good choice for your action franchise, but John Woo has such a specific style that I think when he is playing with other people's toys, right? So in this case, working with characters that aren't his, stories that aren't his, in a world that he hasn't really created, I think things go wrong. And the thing that everyone knows about John Woo is that after switching to English language films, he kind of never was able to recreate any of the highs of his career like you see in Hard Boiled. Some people like Face Off, or they think they like Face Off. They're actually wrong. They don't like Face Off. I'm kidding, obviously. I don't like Face Off.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie kind of centers around a relationship between Ethan Hunt and some woman, and it represents the absolute worst of Hollywood's these two are attractive, they hook up once, so now they're soulmates tendency. Because that's exactly what happens in this movie. They sleep together, and then Ethan spends the whole rest of the movie acting like he has some kind of soul-level connection with this person who he spent very little screen time with, and with whom he's had no conversation of any substance. And yeah, John Woo's weird action kickflips and the jumping to the side while firing two guns and the doves. That's really weird. I don't understand it. So it all ends up in a product that I think is compromised at a pretty foundational level.
Yeah, and I can see, this is also at the bottom of my ranking. I can see how it would be entertaining for some people. There are moments in this where it's so ridiculous that I am kind of having fun with it. When Ethan Hunt drives a motorcycle through a bunch of fire to like a heavenly chorus of dramatic, like this is the second coming of Jesus type buildup, I can see why that would be entertaining, right? I just don't think anything in this movie is exciting or fun enough to be justifying how much style John Woo is putting on this movie. It's tough to even say if there is an action set piece, centerpiece to this film, because none of them are that impressive. There's a heist, because like in every Mission Impossible movie, also... this will be relevant later on, but by the time you watch the fourth Mission Impossible movie, you might be able to parse out that all of these have basically the same plot. Somebody does something evil, Ethan has to do a ridiculous heist in order to steal a thing for the villain, he does some shenanigans with a mask, and then there's a final kind of face-off. And also he's rogue for the entire... I think in the entirety of the franchise, there's maybe 30 cumulative minutes where Ethan is actually working for the IMF. For the entire rest of the runtime, he's rogue. He's not liked. But yeah, there's not really any good action set piece in this movie. There's a motorcycle chase at the end that's a fairly standard motorcycle chase sort of thing. Like you mentioned, there's a Bond girl sort of relationship between Ethan and Thandie Newton's character. that doesn't go anywhere and, like, aggressively doesn't go anywhere. Some of these movies start to pick up dropped plot threads. They refuse to pick up any plot thread from Mission Impossible 2. Anthony Hopkins never shows up again as the weirdly misogynistic head of the IMF.
Well, literally no secretary has two movies.
As head of the IMF?
Yeah.
What about Alec Baldwin?
He's the head of the CIA in Rogue Nation.
Okay. And then Kittredge isn't the head of the IMF in the last two?
Spoilers. He's also the head of the CIA in the last two.
What on earth? All right. Well, anyway. Yeah, also the villain in Mission Impossible 2 is a terrible, terrible villain. It is so... Again, it's a villain who's just, like, evil because, like, he's evil, bro. At no point does he ever explain anything. And, yeah. The movie has very little... going right for it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say. It's just not very good.
All right, well, that brings us to Mission Impossible 3. Elliot, where's this fallen for you? I'm really interested to know where this falls for you, actually.
This is number 6. Oh. So the original trilogy collectively makes up the bottom 3 of my list.
Hmm.
And I don't think that this movie's very good, but it's at least entertaining, I think, for the first time. Or not the first time, because the first one's entertaining. But this is the one that I would say I enjoyed more of it than I didn't enjoy, although by a fairly thin margin. This is the one directed by J.J. Abrams, and you can tell because it's very sentimental. The color saturation was done by an insane person, and the lens flares are out of control. Somebody needs to revoke J.J. Abrams's lens flare privileges immediately. But I think there's fun to be had in this movie. Philip Seymour Hoffman, he is carrying this movie on his weary little shoulders. And it's not even that this villain is good, because he's not. It's that Philip Seymour Hoffman plays him with a coldness and an intensity that I think more than a few of the villains of the franchise try to imitate, but nobody ever manages to successfully recreate. Is that because Henry Cavill is just a worse actor than Philip Seymour Hoffman? Yes. But also, it's because that I think that this guy, because he's a lot more... He's less of a Bond villain, I think, than usual. Because he's essentially a businessman. So he doesn't really have any elaborate multi-stage plan. He's in it for the money, rather than world domination or world destruction. So that lets him, I think, or it makes him more intimidating because he's a little bit more realistic. I think that the whole thing of Ethan being married is not a terrible idea, but it doesn't really go anywhere. Aaron Paul is in this movie. That's fun. It's nice to see him. But he's in a very minor role.
Yeah, he's like a cousin or something like that.
Yeah. This is the movie where they introduce Benji, who will be with us for the rest of the franchise. And I like him. I like Simon Pegg. So, yeah, the movie's fine. It's Dr. Manhattan is in it. That's pretty crazy. And he is the actual villain, actually. Yeah, he ends up. But what is his reasoning for that?
I don't know. Something about we need villains to do villain things in order for, like, America to be strong or something like that.
Oh.
Something that makes a lot
good
of sense.
Good point.
Yeah. Well, this is where we're going to split apart a little bit. This is my second favorite one.
Holy cow!
Well, and a part of that might have been I watched 2 and 3 back-to-back. So it could have just been such a breath of fresh air from the second one that I was maybe blinded to this movie's flaws. But I agree with everything you said. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman is really fantastic. He's a villain who, in my mind, because he genuinely seems like a sociopath, he doesn't need to explain why he's evil. It's clear. He's been murdering squirrels since he was three. Why is he evil? He was born that way. I don't know. And, you know, that's what I'm talking about when the villain has to be intimidating if he's not going to be interesting. He has to be Darth Vader or he has to be the Joker. He can't be, you know, something in between those two. So I think Philip Seymour Hoffman is a great villain. I, for whatever reason, I find J.J. Abrams' style here to be really sick and not really corny and lame. I agree, the lens flares are out of control. There's no reason to have lens flares in like a normal conversation scene between Ethan and his fiance. There's no reason for that. But it looks neat, and I think... yeah, like you said, we get Benji here, and Benji's a great character. I do think he's probably my favorite character in this whole franchise. This movie doesn't also, like number two, doesn't really have a big action set piece. It has a heist scene, but the movie kind of skates around the heist a little bit. I think the Vatican City scene is a really fantastic sequence. I also think the opening of this movie is so great and just does an amazing job of making the movie feel very energized, that this movie opens on a very tense sequence between the villain and Ethan and Julie, or Julia, one of the two, I can't remember. But I just think this movie, it's not without its flaws. I think, like a lot of these movies, Ethan's teammates, who aren't named Luther or Benji, have no personality and struggle to justify their existence in the movie aside from being the people that Ethan has to boss around because he can't do all of these jobs alone. But I just think this movie is a lot of fun. I think the final sequence is really great. Especially, like, the very final part where Ethan is, like, explaining to his wife how to shoot a gun before he has to, you know, kill himself and then bring himself back to life. That's a crazy thing. I just think this movie is a lot of fun. I have a good time with it.
Wow.
So it's number three.
Interesting.
I also, let me just say this, I 100% called the twist villain. It was the easiest thing I've ever seen. I've watched so many movies. I'm such a genius. As soon as they started suspecting the head of the IMF, I was like, it's definitely that other dude who's Ethan's friend. Like, I would wager $1 million that it's him and not the obvious villain. And then he says that great line about, like, if the flag isn't red, it's just because I'm not bleeding on it or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. Anyway, we can move on to, you know, now here we're coming to the kind of the modern stuff. Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol, directed by Brad Bird. This is where Christopher McQuarrie starts to come in, because I'm pretty sure he's the screenwriter of this movie. But Brad Bird's still in the director's seat, not McQuarrie. Elliot, where's this one fall for you?
Let me look at my list. I keep on clicking out of my list. There's really no reason to do that. This is number four for me. Number four is number four. I like this movie. I think you're right. This is when the movie enters, I think, or adopts a lot of the tropes and styles that the franchise will carry for the rest of its existence. So this is the movie that I think most viewers of the modern Mission Impossible franchise will be most familiar with, aside from the ones that they've already seen. It introduces the constant thing of the team needing to the MacGuffin MacGuffins it introduces, which were already kind of present, but heavy focus on MacGuffins, and there will always, from this point on, there will always be a time where Ethan realizes that in order to stop the villain's plan, they need to give the MacGuffin to the villain, actually. They need to let him go forward with his plan, and then, only then, will they be able to stop him. But actually, that doesn't end up working, so they go through this insanely elaborate multi-step plan to try to win by subterfuge. They get discovered. There's a chase scene. They don't recover the MacGuffin, so now the villain is pretty much can activate it at his pleasure. They figure out where he's going to do that. They figure out how to stop it, and then they have a more action-centric conflict where they have to recover the MacGuffin. It also introduces the institution of Ethan dealing with insanely attractive women who he doesn't trust and are ambiguous to villainous. So I think this movie's pretty good. I think Brad Bird, it's not difficult to tell that this is from a director who cut his teeth in animation, because there are just a lot of jokes and gags that you would expect to see in a cartoon, that they're very physical, they're often a little bit goofy, and I thought it worked for the most part. This also introduces the I don't even know. From here on out, the villains are only going to get worse. And this villain is... I don't understand. I have no idea why he's doing what he's doing. I think that maybe it's kind of implied, or they have like a few lines about him wanting to destroy the world because he thinks that humanity will get stronger afterwards. Why he thinks he can achieve that with nuclear war is beyond me. Also, Ethan has a fight with him, and it's this, like, slightly overweight, middle-aged man who should in no way, shape, or form pose a threat to him. So it's a lot like the fight between John Wick and the elderly Russian gangster at the end of the first movie. But yeah, I think that the set pieces are fun. I actually like the intricate multi-phase plans of just working around problems. I really enjoy that. I think that I'm not sure why this movie introduces the character of Agent Brandt, who's played by Jeremy Renner and will be with us briefly. And he has a connection to Ethan that I don't understand why they need that. It's not very well developed. It doesn't really go anywhere. So yeah, the movie's not perfect, and it makes some own goals, I would say, or some unforced errors. But in general, it's a fun time. I liked watching it.
Yeah, you've kind of taken a lot of the words out of my mouth. This is also fourth for me for a lot of the reasons you've already said. I would just expand that, once again, they haven't solidified Ethan's team yet. They're still introducing kind of new characters every movie, kind of throwing darts at the wall to see what sticks. The people who didn't stick from this movie, it's really obvious why they didn't stick. The people who did, like Benji and Brant briefly, it is easy to see they're, you know, better or more interesting. But yeah, like you mentioned, I find with a lot of these movies, they're trying to convince us of both the peril that the characters are in and the necessity for the characters to go about solving these problems in the way that they're choosing to solve them. And I think Ghost Protocol is probably the worst of these modern Mission Impossible movies at convincing me that this is the best way to solve these things. There's no way that this elaborate, silly Burj Khalifa swap thing is the best possible way for them to get the things they need and keep the things they need from the other characters. I just don't understand why they do it in this fashion. The finale, yeah, like you mentioned, is pretty weak. A large chunk of it is devoted to a woman seducing a, like, 30 or 40-year-old Indian man, which is just not, like, the most exciting way to end an action movie. So, yeah, it's got some issues. It's better than some of these other movies, I think, because the set pieces are... when there's an actual set piece, it is pretty good. The opening is cool in the prison. The Kremlin infiltration scene is really neat with the ridiculous hallway projector tech thing. And then the Burj Khalifa sequence is, you know, starts the time-honored tradition of Tom Cruise hanging on the side of things that are very high up, which is great. I love that tradition. That's a great tradition. But yeah, Ghost Protocol, it's going to be number 4 for me.
But also, it's funny how the villain, see, I can't even remember his name. The villain, he wants to start a nuclear war, so he takes control of and fires a single nuclear missile at the United States from a Russian submarine. And the movie acts like now the point of no return is when that missile explodes. But in reality, America has billions of dollars of resources dedicated to monitoring for this kind of thing, and they would have fired back immediately.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Also, just to kind of flex on my knowledge of nuclear missiles, the missile probably would have done an airburst, not a ground detonation, so it actually would have detonated about where it gets shut off, rather than, like, hitting the ground and exploding.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, the next movie, I'm going to maybe jump ahead of you a little bit here, because the next one is Rogue Nation, and this is my number one favorite Mission Impossible movie. I think this one has the best team with the best chemistry in Benji, Luther, Brandt, and Ilsa. I think Ilsa, she's not a great character, but she's a better character than a lot of the female foils have been thus far for Ethan. The set pieces in this movie are great. The first one, him hanging off of a plane that's taking off, that's great. That's a neat, I mean, I've seen how it's filmed. That's crazy. Like, he just did it. You know, there was wires and stuff, but... And then also the sequence where he once again has to heist something for the villain, because the villain in this scene, in this one, the villain has tricked him into heisting it. So it's a little better than previous ones where he chooses to heist it. He does ultimately still kind of give the villain the thing. But it's good. The heist scene is really great. I feel like this is the movie that maybe does the best job of giving Ethan some more character. I think that sequence at the beginning where Ethan gets his mission in the classic Mission Impossible way, and then it turns out that it's the Syndicate and they've infiltrated it, and then he sees this innocent woman killed by the villain. I think it's so great, and it's a chilling scene. It's really well done, and it really establishes Ethan as, you know, kind of what they really run into the ground over the course of these next 4 movies. Ethan doesn't want anyone to die, unless they're the villain, in which case death is coming soon, because he's Ethan Hunt, the physical manifestation of destiny, or whatever Alec Baldwin says in this movie. But yeah, it's a really good movie. Rogue Nation is a ball and a half.
Wow. Well, I agree mostly. This is my number 2 pick, so this is my second favorite. And I agree with pretty much everything that you said. I really like Ilsa. I think Rebecca Ferguson does a great job playing her. I like Brandt in this movie. I like him a lot more than I did in Ghost Protocol, and I was kind of sad to see him vanish for no reason in Fallout.
What? There's meta reason. Tom Cruise doesn't like Jeremy Renner, evidently.
Oh, really?
So he doesn't show up again because Tom... That's also why in this movie he spends the majority of his screen time talking to Ethan through like a phone and stuff. There's only one sequence at the end where Jeremy Renner and Tom Cruise are physically in the same place and would have had to share a set. Fun fact.
That's so petty.
Well, you know, he's working on it through Scientology or whatever.
Oh, yes.
His pettiness, okay. That is.
Well, anyway, I think that this movie suffers chiefly from a lack of real stakes, because unlike most of these movies, which at least have a clearly defined plan for the villain, here the stakes are a lot more amorphous, because Ethan is just trying to expose and stop a terrorist organization for things that they've done in the past. They're not working on anything in the immediate term that he's trying to stop. He's just trying to stop them because they are bad. So just hearing about how bad they are is not particularly convincing. But yeah, I think that this movie has great stunts. I really like the set piece in the opera. Especially since it ends on a great note where I just like things that are clever, because I'm not clever, so I'm easily impressed. But Ethan having one bullet to try and stop two assassins, so he uses it to shoot the target, right, so that the target is wounded and their security forces protect them. That's great. I really like that. And yeah, I think that that's... So we're in the Macquarie era at this point. Yeah. And I think that throughout the rest of the movies, in their highs and lows, that is the kind of attention to detail that we can expect going forward, which I just appreciate. I like things that have that level of thought put into them.
Yeah, it's a fun time movie. Also, Ethan once again going rogue for the sake. Although his going rogue never seems to inhibit him from having an endless supply of tech and like places to hide from. I don't understand how he's able to be rogue and then still have like the boat that he has in this movie. Did they not do an inventory and they're like, dude, one of our high tech super secret boats was taken. Like, let's go get it, bro. I don't know. Anyway. Anyway, the next one, another Christopher McQuarrie one, and this is probably, besides the part one and part two, this is very connected to Rogue Nation. That's going to be Mission Impossible Fallout. Elliot, where's this one? I could guess where it falls, but where does this one fall?
This is my favorite.
Okay.
This is my pick for the best of the franchise. And it's not a flawless movie. The usual issues of the characters are a little two-dimensional, and the villain especially is not particularly engaging, but I think that this movie is really where Christopher McQuarrie hits his stride in terms of, this is the kind of movie that I want to make. I think that this movie has the best action in terms of the actual fisticuffs between characters. There's a fight in a bathroom that's really good. The famous one where Henry Cavill reloads his fists. The man himself, he's not the best actor in the world, but right, he's big and burly, and he can do cold and ruthless, so I think that's good. I really like the I mean, at this point, they're starting to push it in terms of just how elaborate and truly dangerous their stunts are with this whole thing on of Tom Cruise free climbing a helicopter, which is quite interesting. But I think in general, I like Fallout the most because it's kind of sandwiched in between Christopher McQuarrie hitting his stride with his the cast of characters that he wants. So, right, Ilsa's back. The team has solidified at this point. And on the other side of the movie is the finale, essentially, when the movies necessarily change and expand because you can't, the finale can never be, right, just another day at the office. So the stakes have to increase. You have to go bigger. You have to go louder. So I think this movie is perfectly placed in terms of its commitments to to improving on the last one, but also not needing the sense of insanity to wrap up a franchise that at this point has become known for madness. Or that sounds more derogatory than I mean it. That's become known for spectacle. Those commitments, I think, are perfectly balanced in this movie.
Yeah, this is number three for me. I agree with a lot of what you said. This is definitely in the top tier. If we were doing a tier list instead of a ranking, this would be in the top tier with Mission Impossible 3 and Rogue Nation. I think they're very similar in terms of quality. Like you said, it's got really great stunts. Yeah, the fight scene in the bathroom is super sick. That's a great fight scene. The movie is just, for my money, it's a little bloated. The 15-minute timer at the end of the film takes 20-some minutes to go off. And it's just really ridiculous. By the end of it, I'm kind of rolling my eyes at the level of, look at how much nonsense we're having to deal with in order to defuse these things and make the stakes higher and higher and higher. But it's a lot of fun. Again, the team, I like the team that they've chosen to go with because they're easily the most charismatic and best of the bunch. There's some silliness here, but for the most part, this is a really good action movie. Like you said, Christopher McQuarrie is very much in his bag. He knows what he wants to do, and he knows how to do it. So it's good. It's a good, you know, it's a good solid movie.
I will say that this is the movie this is in the unofficial trilogy of Fallout, Dead Reckoning, and The Final Reckoning. This is the movie that introduces a conflict, or I should say a supposed conflict, about Ethan being unwilling to sacrifice his friends for the greater good, that the movies will stubbornly refuse to interrogate or to really challenge the character in terms of making those hard decisions, which I think is a missed opportunity in this movie, and that missed opportunity is only going to continue to be missed for the next two movies.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and that's just another aspect, in my mind, of Ethan not being a particularly interesting character, because these movies fail to put him in interesting predicaments. I mean, almost all of these movies, the predicament that he's put in is essentially boils down to, can he do some crazy, insane, one-in-a-million chance thing in order to prevent the villain? And, yeah, like you said, they never do. Like, he genuinely has to choose between saving Benji or saving the world. And Rogue Nation kind of does that, too, where it's like, oh, he's going to have to choose, and then he does some shenanigans so he doesn't have to choose. Which, I get it. We don't want to put the, you know, it's an action movie franchise. It's not the, Stalker or something. I apologize for bringing it up. It was just the first philosophical movie that came to my mind. So, you know, you don't want to have the audience sitting in too much discomfort, but I feel like they, you know, they could have some stakes or at least some deliverance of these things. But speaking of, this brings us to the final two films. The first one, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. Where does this one fall for you, Elliot?
Oh my gosh. I just, instead of clicking on the tab that I have this on, I clicked on the X, so I closed the tab. Sorry.
Well, it's 5 or 6.
It's true. And it is... Dead Reckoning. What? No, this is 3 for me.
What was Fallout?
That was 1.
Oh, Fallout was 1. Okay, yeah, I said that. Never mind, never mind. I've kept a poor record of numbers that you've had. Okay, number 3.
Yeah, this is my third favorite, and it's the one that I rewatched most recently. And I think that this is where we're starting to get some problems, where scope creep is starting to. Is threatening to overwhelm my ability to be invested, right? It's getting too crazy at this point. Which is not to say that the movie's bad by any means. I think this movie's pretty good. I would probably give it like a B minus, maybe a B. Or actually, I think I reviewed it for the blog and I gave it like an A or something. Wow. But opinions change. I think that what's good about this movie is what's always been good about these movies, or what's been good about these movies since Ghost Protocol. They look really slick. The cinematography is nice. The music continues to be great. There's great action. I'm not super impressed with Tom Cruise driving a motorcycle off of a ramp on a mountain. That seems like not all that different from just jumping out of an airplane, because he's got a parachute and it's high up. But yeah, I think that I'm glad that there's some meaningful character deaths. Right? Like, Ilsa dies in this, and it makes me sad, because I like the character, and I like Rebecca Ferguson. So, I'm glad about that, and that helps keep me invested, and keep me wondering about, well, are they gonna go even further? Unfortunately not. But, yeah, in terms of what's not so good, I think that Gabriel is a decidedly one-note villain, as is the Entity. I think that the Entity is a real missed opportunity, because it's an evil AI, and we've seen plenty of evil AIs, but in this day and age, I feel like the question of AI could have facilitated a much more interesting villain. But it remains vague in most areas, and in the areas where its intentions are clear, it has limited motivations, and its intentions are frustratingly generic of, I will take over the world now. So yeah, that's unfortunate. But there are some great set pieces in here. The fight in this like super narrow alley, where you can't even turn around, I think is great. It's a great example of what I would say is good expansion, or not really expansion, but a good way to keep action fresh, right? If it had just been Tom Cruise fighting two people in a room like usual, it would have been pretty uninteresting. But this geography presents new and interesting ways to choreograph and to film, and I think that they took full advantage of that. It's also got a great car chase. I like Grace, the new character. She's not my favorite, but I think that she's a worthy addition. Carrie, what's his last name? Carrie Ulas? Ulas?
Oh, yeah.
The guy from The Princess Bride. He plays an antagonist, which is kind of funny. Yeah, I think it's a solid movie.
Yeah, I have it at number 5. I agree with some of your positives on the movie. I think Grace is decent. I think that Venice set piece was sick, and not just because I could point at the screen and go, dude, I've been there. That's crazy. I know where that is. Not the alleyway, but like St. Mark's Square. I know where that is. It's at St. Mark's Square. But I do think this movie has less exciting set pieces. The train sequence at the end, I'm not lying here, it's better in Uncharted 2. The train set piece in that is like way better than this one. And not just because this one has dodgy CGI in multiple moments, which is crazy because they're so committed to practical effects. And then there's like noticeably janky looking chairs and stuff falling. I agree. Gabriel, the Mission Impossible franchise is filled with terrible villains. For my money, Gabriel might be the worst. There's like an insane retcon at the beginning of this movie where it's like you join the IMF because of Gabriel. None of this is explained, by the way. Like, there's no further discussion of what Gabriel did or his connection to Ethan that caused him to murder this woman that is one of the, you know, hundreds of women that Ethan Hunt has been deeply in love with through his life. And that happens in, like, the first 2 minutes. Like, the first 2 minutes of the movie is an insane retconning that made me genuinely think, did I miss a movie? Did I skip a movie? Have I been watching, like, ones without deleted scenes? I was genuinely thrown for such a loop because of it. And then, yeah, Gabriel is kind of a weak villain. I do think the entity is somewhat interesting, and the way the entity makes itself known in the film is cool. I like the sequence when Luther keeps changing the faces of other people to make the American soldiers or whatever they are supposed to be think that Ethan is in a certain place. I think that's really neat. The sequence where the entity impersonates Benji is so sick. Like, that's such a great, that Venice sequence was so good. Holy cow. But it doesn't really go much of anywhere. And yeah, the entity is kind of tough as a villain because it's intimidating, but it's not the most intimidating because its objectives are kind of unclear. And, you know, this is going to carry over into the discussion of the next movie, but Gabriel is kind of in a similar boat, that Gabriel is such a an unknown factor that it's tough for me to feel like he's intimidating or interesting because I have nothing to go on. So overall, this is just, it's a good action movie. Every time the movie is an action sequence, it's really good, but this movie's like 2 hours and 45 minutes long. So a lot of it is not action movie stuff. And that's why it's number 5 for me.
Well, I just want to say I had the exact same reaction to learning about Ethan's girlfriend or whoever that Gabriel killed. Because I watched the first 3 movies for the first time after having watched Dead Reckoning, so I was convinced that I was going to see that at some point. Like, no. I was every movie it didn't happen, I was like, oh, I guess it's gonna happen in the next one. And in the third one, when it was continuing to not happen, I was like, wait, did I miss it in the fourth one? Was it in Fallout and I just missed it? So yeah, that was destabilizing.
Yeah, I watched them all the way through. Like, I watched 1 through 8 in the last, like, 2 weeks. And, yeah, that was really something for me. But anyway, we're bringing it home. The new Mission Impossible movie, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, it's in theaters right now. There's going to be some spoilers here, but, you know, maybe we can open it with some non-spoiler thoughts and then jump into more spoiler sort of things. Elliot, where's this ranking for you? I guess our discerning listeners should already be able to guess, assuming you haven't introduced some shenanigans in your ranking system.
No. This is number 5 for me. Yeah. And honestly, this was the hardest one to place because there's so much about it that I like and so much about it that I don't like that it's difficult to determine that any placement feels wrong, right? Like, placing it at number 3 or 4 feels too high because there's so many problems with it. But placing it at 5 or 6, as I have done, honestly feels too low because there's so much about it that I do think is good. So, yeah, this one is... I'll say that this movie is an experience, a cinematic experience. Like, if you are at all interested in this movie, I would say go to the theater and watch it because that is probably the best way to watch it. I think that this movie has some mind-blowing stunts, like the stuff on the biplanes. It's really all happening. The stuff on the biplanes, that is insane, man. I read the New York Times because I'm just really cool like that. And they had an opinion piece about the author, how the author doesn't like how the Mission Impossible movies keep on going bigger and louder with the stunts. And that's the kind of issues forward journalism that keeps the gray lady in the conversation. But I'm saying I disagree with that person entirely because I think that this stunt is incredible. And Tom Cruise, look, he's a weirdo, but he's talented and he puts in the work. And I think he's a good actor. The scope is, and the scale, it's just inherently entertaining, to me at least. The entity continues to frustrate as a villain because at this point I have no idea why it's doing what it's doing. It's got a plan. The plan is ridiculous. Or it's not ridiculous, but the plan, I don't understand what the entity is getting out of it. Gabriel is still here despite being at odds with the entity in some way. And I don't want Gabriel to still be here. I want him to go away. And just in general, there's some weird threads that the movie takes up and then kind of abandons towards the end. Which I guess I won't say for spoiler reasons. But yeah, this movie is... It's frustrating. It's frustratingly good, but also frustratingly frustrating.
Yeah, this is number 7 for me, and I think...
Whoa!
Look, I agree with everything you said. I think the problems with it are a bigger problem for me than they are for you. I think, the last probably 30 minutes of this movie is worth the price of admission alone. The sequence at the end is crazy. It's unbelievable that they found a way to, like, safely film all of that nonsense.
Not sure it was safe.
Well, you know, I have faith in the good working members of our stunt unions.
As safe as it could be.
Yeah. It's crazy how much of what you're seeing is most likely fairly real. That's crazy. I think the movie does a really good job of convincing you that this is really an impossible mission, that what is happening is genuinely a one in a million sort of chance thing. I was getting tense and, you know, nervous in this last sequence, even though I will say this, the ending of this movie is basically the same as the ending to Mission Impossible Fallout. It has basically the same structure with a couple of things tweaked. That's kind of a spoiler, I guess, but, you know, surely if you've seen Mission Impossible Fallout, you've seen this one by this point, I guess. But I think to get into more spoilers, because I don't really feel like I can talk about why this is seventh for me without getting into more spoilers. Huge chunks of this movie that is 3 hours long is dedicated to flashbacks and Marvel-style, like, nostalgia bait cameos that I do not, and not even the cameos that I wanted it to do. They bring back William Dunlow, who, whatever, that's neat. I guessed it as soon as they said they were going to a station up north. I'm like, bro, that's, I watched Mission Impossible 1 a couple weeks ago. That's exactly where they said they sent Dunlow. Which I was like, dang, what a lucky break for them that they could loop this in because of this one random line of dialogue from a movie almost 30 years ago. But anyway, a lot of this movie is also dedicated to, like, flashback scenes of people explaining things, that, like, a character will explain a thing, and then it'll show that thing happening. And I'm like, I am not 2 years old. Do not show me that. This movie is 3 hours long. We got to be aggressive in the editing room. Not so every time. I think they showed that shot of the guy walking back into the black vault at the CIA and, like, picking up the knife. They had to have shown it, like, 6 or 7 times in this movie. That's ridiculous. And, yeah, Gabriel is a terrible villain, continues to be a terrible villain. The entity, because the entity never makes its plans known, which, to be fair, why would it make its plan? Like, why would it tell anyone? But because of that, it's tough for me to really feel like, again, this is the character's only conceivable option, because we don't know that that's their only conceivable option. Like, I think Gabriel has a good argument when he's saying, hey, if the entity doesn't get into this vault, I'm going to call its bluff. I don't think it's going to blow us all up. I think there's merit to that. I think we could, and I think, also, as a computer scientist, the entity kind of bugged me because it did a couple of things that I'm like, that's not how the internet works. That's not how AIs work. That's not how anything works, which was annoying to me. But overall, I just felt like the movie was so bloated. It takes so long to get to any place that's interesting or exciting. It does kill Luther, which, again, you know, I sound like a psychopath that I'm always wanting movie franchises to kill more characters. I'm just saying, this is, I feel very strongly that the reason why Walking Dead and Game of Thrones were so beloved by people is
because... Two shows that you have never seen.
Correct. But my belief that why people found it so exciting to watch was because it felt like any character could die. And that's because they tricked you into thinking that, because they had 18 gajillion characters in all of those shows. And again, I haven't seen it, so I can't, like, I don't have a ton of evidence for this. But I feel like when you kill a character, that's how you, you know, show you're serious. That this thing, like, if the screenwriter is willing to kill that character, what are the odds they'll kill another character? Pretty good. So I like it when they, you know, kill someone to show you're serious, screenwriting-wise. But then they don't kill Ethan, which it just really bugs me. I just don't understand why they would do that. I don't like finales that then turn out to be like, well, there could be another one, wink, wink. I don't like that. You know, end and then be done. Don't do this half-hearted sort of stuff. So that was a really long rant here, but I just saw this movie yesterday, and it really was, like you said, it's really frustrating because there's so many parts of this movie, not so many parts, there's chunks of this movie that are so, so fantastic. Again, the last 30 minutes are insanely good and maybe the best 30 minutes in the entire Mission Impossible franchise. You just have to get through 2 hours and 20 minutes of mediocre expositioning and nostalgia baiting in order to get to it.
Well, I don't know if I fully agree. I definitely don't agree with the idea that The Walking Dead is really interesting and engaging to watch. I've seen 2 seasons of that show, and maybe it gets really interesting and engaging in season 3. But I guess just to join you a bit in spoiler territory, there are some weird things that this movie does narratively that made me suspect it was the victim of some fairly rushed reshoots. I'm thinking specifically of the movie seems to set itself up for a finale on the ice above where the submarine has sunk, because there's a flash forward to it exploding. Ethan very pointedly makes Grace promise that she won't be on the ice, which just, like, maybe I've just seen too many movies, right? And these kinds of things, I'm just overly sensitive to things that could be foreshadowing. But to my mind, that seems, that doesn't go anywhere, right? Because Grace does get on the ice. She's the one to save Ethan, but that never comes back into play. And same thing with, it has this time jump where the entity is now known to most of humanity, and there's like a cult that worships it. And aside from a single person who betrays Ethan on another submarine, that never comes into play. So, like, why is it even there? And I'm not sure why the crazy French woman is a character, because she doesn't really do anything.
She saves Benji.
That's true, but they... Okay, well, if that's the only reason she's there, I'm going to have to say that that's a poor reason to add an entirely new character. Yeah, it's just a little weird. It's strangely sloppy in my mind. Yeah. Just because it's, I mean, I am of the opinion that if you introduce something to a movie, like an actual plot point or something that seems like it's significant and doesn't go anywhere, like, for example, the idea that a zone is full of weird things happening in Russia, that should actually play a part in the plot. And if it's not going to, just don't have it in there. Why include it at all?
All right, well,
Stalker review coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to do a Stalker review because we disagree vehemently on the purposes of that film. So I don't think it would go anywhere. But I agree, yeah. I would say it's not wrong of you to assume that there was foreshadowing that something would happen with the submarine and on the ice. The movie was blatantly saying that something was going to happen. We were shown something happening. You could argue, if you're a Mission Impossible stan and you're dedicated to...
Stan? What does that mean?
Like the Eminem song, you know? It's like a fan, but kind of to a psychotic level.
Oh, okay.
You could argue...
Eminem song?
Yeah, the Eminem song Stan.
What?
With Dido? Anyway, you could argue that the entity didn't know that Dunlow had taken a wife, and so the fact that
she... had taken a wife?
Yeah, had fallen in love with someone, and so the fact that she was there to help Grace was the determining factor in helping Grace stay alive on the ice. I don't see how that's a, like, remotely feasible argument, because clearly the entity showed Ethan that the submarine might explode because of him being in it, which would kill Grace regardless of what old Inuit women were there. I'm just saying, if you're crazy, you could make that argument, or you could make some other sort of argument. I do think the character is very consistently being like, don't do that. That's what the entity wants. That's so fun. There's so much on Letterboxd, which I'm a, you know, huge Letterboxd fan. A lot of the reviews are like...
I'm a huge Letterboxd enemy.
A bunch of the reviews are like, we can't hate this movie. It's what the entity wants. It's trying to divide us. You have to like it.
That's the other thing that never really... The other thing that was set up that never really came into play is this idea of needing to defeat the entity by coming together. Mm. The entity was banking on humanity being tribalist and... suspicious of each other. And the way that plays out in the movie is Ethan kind of makes friends with the one guy who's been hunting him. The guy from, he's one of the detectives in Joker.
Yeah, Shea Wingham.
Yes. So, again, just things throughout, the, just like things that seem to be foreshadowing something that's not happening. And maybe the movie is just hoodwinking us. And Christopher McQuarrie, he's listening to this right now and he's laughing. He's like rubbing his hands together like a fly saying they fell for my trap. In which case I would say, good job.
Yeah,
I guess it worked.
Yeah, you tricked us into not liking your movie. What a genius level ploy. No, I agree. That doesn't really go anywhere. I don't want to. We don't have to keep talking about the final reckoning like we're going to review it. I will say, though, in my theater, when the president was given like a list of American cities that she could nuke to show the other countries that like it's nothing personal or whatever, someone in the theater fairly loudly said she's going to pick Des Moines, Iowa, which I thought was pretty funny. She should have picked Des Moines, Iowa.
Dude, I guess the people in my theater were not respecting theater etiquette.
Oh, dang. Right?
There was talking going on at the volume that, like, conversation volume.
Wow.
And I just want to say that's unacceptable.
Yeah. Okay?
And I think that person should have been arrested.
Okay. All right. Like those kids in the Minecraft movie showing who started a riot.
Exactly. 10 years hard labor. That'll teach them.
All right. Anyway. That's the end of our rankings. So, and that's
hard and full of disappointments.
Yeah, maybe that's the end of the Mission Impossible franchise because
Mission Impossible.
Ethan Hunt inexplicably had a second parachute that no one I've talked to has any idea how he got it. I think an angel descended from heaven and gave it to him. Though, speaking of funny Letterboxd reviews, there was also a review saying, like, in the first two movies, Ethan is like a decent spy, like a pretty good spy with neat tech. In the third and fourth movie, he's like a really good spy who's doing some really impressive things. In the fifth and sixth movie, he's like genuinely blessed by the fates and it's crazy how he's doing all these things. In the seventh and eighth, he's just like Jesus Christ. Like he can do everything. I think at one point someone like genuinely refers to Ethan Hunt as he's like God in terms of his odds of doing impossible things, which I just think is kind of funny. But speaking of, you know, somehow he's able to conjure a second parachute out of nowhere. So the movie doesn't have to kill him because they're cowards. And once, you know, just to do a parting shot from the Bond fandom to the Mission Impossible fandom, they killed Bond, bro. Like, the people doing Bond had some balls. They killed James Bond. Ethan Hunt had to fold. He couldn't see that raise to use a Casino Royale.
Bond is coming back.
I know. Well, Ethan Hunt could come back too. I'm just saying they didn't even have the guts to do it for one movie.
But I don't see how it matters if you're just going to keep on making movies. If you're just going to keep on rebooting things, then no ending, no matter how seemingly final is final.
All right. Anyway,
are you gonna play the James Bond game?
What James Bond game?
The people who made the Hitman games, they're making a James Bond game.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yeah, he's like weirdly young. He doesn't look like James Bond. Every time I see a picture, I think
it's his first mission.
I know, but I think it is supposed to be his first mission. Every time I see a picture of it, I haven't watched the gameplay trailer yet. I want to play it. That seems like a lot of fun. I love James Bond. I love when there's going to be a dialogue prompt to say a corny, you know, catchphrase. Like you throw someone in a fan and you say like, I guess he wasn't a fan of that or something like that. Or when you show back up and, you know, you have to get the other characters to set up an innuendo for you. Like every time that Moneypenny is saying, you know, where's Bond? Oh, he's busy. She never says he's busy. She says something and then it cuts and it's like, oh, she meant like sexually.
Where's Bond? Oh, he's in bed with some hot.
Yeah, and then it'll cut to him in bed.
Wow.
It's so funny. Gosh, I love James Bond. One of these days, I'll get you to watch all of them, and then we can do a James Bond ranking episode. And it'll just be me
saying, on that day, there will be bloodshed.
Well, I was going to say that would just be, you know, probably 20 examples of you saying this is tied for last. This is tied for the bottom. And then like 5 movies that you're like, yeah, this is not terrible. Anyway,
well, let's not let people too deep into our plans.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Anna Brooks for the great idea. This really panned out well for us. So we're going to be back next week. We're going to be reviewing another movie. We're going to be working, you know, maybe before episode 160, we'll be able to get the 70s episode to you. But I wouldn't bank on it. I would not predict that.
Look, I want to say this is my fault. Nathan is not at fault whatsoever here. This is my fault because I've started working many more hours at my job over the summer. I have a lot less time to watch movies, so I do apologize. This is the delays are because of me, not because of Nathan.
Well, you don't have to apologize for getting a job. We all, most of us listening, probably live in, you know, in a system where money must be traded for goods and services. So we get it.
Who doesn't? Maybe there's someone in the an uncontacted tribe. The North Sentinel Island. They're fans of Magellan's at the Movies.
I meant someone who lives in like North Korea or something, but I don't know. Anyway,
I'm sure you still have to work in North Korea.
I don't know about North Korea. I'm trying to end the episode. Elliot.
Sorry.
Thank you so much for listening. We're gonna be back next week. We're gonna have a brand new episode. Look forward to that. Send us an email. You know, do you vehemently disagree with our ranking? Do you think that Mission Impossible 2 is an unsung classic of action movie cinema? Send us an email if you have an idea for a special episode that we can do while we continue to put off doing the best of the 70s. And we hope you have a great week in between.